Got a very special episode of Paranormally Speaking this week. I have a guest, award-winning author, and alien abduction expert. I'm talking about Ron Felber, PhD, who has also been interviewed by George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM and Beyond Belief with George Norrie, as well as many others. Let's give it up for Mr. Ron Felber.
Expensive than you ever anticipate, I promise.
No, with the price hike on everything anymore.
Everything. Yeah, no, it's really crazy. And you know, the other thing is the quality is just not there. There's a boxer that I follow who was interviewed after a fight, and I guess they were talking about Showtime not doing boxing anymore. And he said, you know, everything's changed since COVID. Even the food doesn't taste the same.
Oh, and, no.
You know, he's right.
Recording in progress.
Yeah. The food doesn't taste the same.
No, everything as far as human nature and the overall behavioral patterns of people in general, no matter what setting you're in, has changed drastically. It's almost like there was some kind of a paradigm shift between universes, and we're now waking up in another universe where what we used to be is trapped in another.
You know, no, that's really an interesting point. And look at what's gone on with the Pentagon and UFOs. I mean, all of a sudden, what, the Pentagon is releasing, you know, videotapes of UFOs, and you know, directors of national security are saying we have no idea what they are. You know, these are crazy times, that's for sure.
And conveniently, they released all of that information at the height of the pandemic.
Yes, absolutely.
Great time to slip a morsel like that in.
But, you know, the interesting thing is people don't blink.
No.
If the Pentagon had done that, I don't know, let's say 20 years ago, I mean, it would be banner headlines across the world. These days, you talk to somebody and say, isn't that amazing? They go, like, what? And you go, the videotapes that were released by the Pentagon and this and that. And they say, oh, yeah, I think I saw that. It's unbelievable.
We now have a TikTok time span as far as our attention goes.
Yeah, and politicians count on it, too. You can believe that.
They really do. I want to briefly prepare my audience for who you are. First of all, we have a special guest for this episode of Paranormally Speaking. I will be speaking with award-winning author Ron Felber, PhD. Now, it's stated on your profile, you are an author of the Mojave Incident, which is a chilling story of an alien abduction, which was the subject of interviews that you did with George on Coast to Coast AM.
Yes.
Beyond Belief as well with George Norrie, as well as others.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, I know it got quite a bit of airtime and sold quite well because it's such a unique story. You know, it's unlike some of these stories where you catch a glimpse of something or somebody thinks they see something. This had duration to it, and there were two people involved who were very credible. And it's just an astounding story. Not unlike The Unwelcomed, another, you know, I've been very fortunate. Some great stories have fallen into my lap, and I'm forever thankful for it.
Now you mentioned The Unwelcome. That's your new book that's stated as even being more exciting. It's just The Curious Case of Clara Flower, Fowler. Yeah. The story was passed to you by William Peter Blatty, the author of The Exorcist.
Yeah, it's a coincidence. I guess it's a coincidence. You know, I guess they say that, you know, good fortune happens to people that are prepared. And I guess Woody Allen says 80% of success is showing up. So there's no truth to that. I was a student when Bill Blatty and William Friedkin were filming The Exorcist at Georgetown at the university. And a novice author. I had my first novel and, you know, I was very excited that this author who had a bestseller, The Exorcist, on the New York Times bestseller list for 56 weeks was a couple blocks from the classes I attended, you know?
Yeah, that had to be an honor.
Yeah, and I sort of, you know, chased him around, I suppose, if you want to look at it that way, at least to the point where I got to an office that they had across the Potomac at the Key Bridge Marriott. And so I went there and met with his admin, who had a stack of books, manuscripts from writers all over the world, literally, that were sending manuscripts to him. And I convinced her that she should hand my manuscript to him and at least say, you know, I was a Georgetown student, unlike many of the other manuscripts that had been been submitted, like he was, that, you know, I came from the city. I came from Newark, New Jersey, and he came from New York, New York City. We were both there on scholarships for writing. And so I said, you know, but please, just I'm like he was, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Just take a look at my manuscript. And he did. And lo and behold, I went back for Thanksgiving vacation to my parents in New Jersey. And he gave a call and said, you know, I like your book. Come, let's talk about it. And ultimately, what wound up happening was he helped me with my second book, not that one, get published. But he also gave me the story for The Unwelcomed, this case of Clara Fowler, which was studied in Boston, turn of the century, 1898 to 1904, by some of the premier scientists in the country at that time. William James, the famous Harvard professor who basically invented abnormal psychology. Dr. Morton Prince, another Harvard Medical School graduate and lecturer, George Waterman. And under pressure, because there was such a emphasis on spiritualism at the time, both in Europe and in the United States, you had Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of the Sherlock Holmes stories, you had Madame Curie, you had Charles Dickens, you had, you know, scientists, physicists that believed in spiritualism. Mm-hmm. And so he also added to the team Richard Hoxton, who was president of the American Society for Psychical Researchers, and Leonora Piper, who was a clairvoyant at the time.
Yeah, these are all legends that you're naming.
and you know, as a fellow author, talk about something difficult to write. You know, I tried to write it when I was younger, and I failed. I mean, I tried to do it as a documentary. I tried to fictionalize it. I just couldn't get the feel of the turn of the century. I couldn't get that feel. And, you know, when you have characters like Sigmund Freud, how do you draw a character like Sigmund Freud? You know, what is the dialogue like? And so I couldn't do it. But about 3 years ago, I said, you know, let me give it another shot. I'm a little older. Hopefully I'm a much better writer than I was back then. And I think I pulled it off. Reviews have been very, very positive.
I know for myself, since the pandemic, I've had an influx of ideas, and I have become a much better writer myself. So I don't know if it was the vaccine that made me smarter or what. It's made me superhuman writing abilities, but your new book has been hailed as perhaps the most frightening book about demonic possession ever, as real and convincing as a medical case history that it's based upon. You mentioned between 1898 and 1904. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's great to have you on the show this week. In fact, I am honored that you reached out to me and were willing to show up, because I'm no George Norrie by any means, but a lot of people do know of me.
No, absolutely. And I mean, I've seen your biography, and I know about your books, Ghosts from Coast to Coast, et cetera. And you're quite an icon in and of yourself. So don't be so modest.
Well, my wife tells me I have to be.
No, that's what wives were made for.
I mean, I don't want to give away too much about your book, but would you mind sharing with the listening audience a little bit about maybe what direction you were planning on taking it into and how it ended up with the epic ending that you came up with?
Yeah, you know, this is what happened. So Bill Blatty passed the story along, and I did the research. I went to the Harvard Medical School Library, where they had the transcripts, you know, many of the transcripts from psychiatric sessions and retrogressive hypnotic sessions. Also letters that came back and forth between her and her demonic state and in her saintly state. This was a woman, a young student at Radcliffe College in Boston. And basically she was plagued by, at first, visions of Jesus Christ and visions of the Blessed Mother. She wanted to be a nun. She lived a very studious, productive life, you know, a model kind of person. And then she started having these awful nightmares. And and torturous experiences where, for example, when she tried to eat, she would see maggots in her food, so she couldn't eat. When she tried to sleep, she'd have these horrendous nightmares and wake up and find these demons perched on her bedpost, staring down at her. So she suffered from terrible insomnia, a loss of appetite. She couldn't concentrate on things. She would go to church and have stabbing pains that would, you know, gut-wrenching pains that would start to plague her. So she came to Prince after she had been with another doctor, a normal practitioner. Mm-hmm. And this doctor knew that Prince was working with abnormal psychiatrists like William James, and said, you know, I don't know what to do. This girl seems incurable. And if I didn't know better, I would say that she is displaying the symptoms of demonic possession, what people in medieval times would call demonic possession. She had superhuman strength in the second personality. She had a voice that was clearly a man's voice. Her face would remold into a different face. In that state, she felt no pain. She had no need of sleep, no illness. She had pure hatred for the saint, for the original Clara Fowler. Yeah. And would write her threatening notes. You know, I think I have one right here. I'll read to you just as an example. Yeah, hypocrite, whore, how I hate you. The pains of hell shall come down upon thee. You shall find no help, no comfort in heaven or earth from my wrath, not till student Clara is dead and puts a bullet through her head. Devil, devil, devil. So she'd wake up to these kinds of threatening letters, and she'd have lacerations on her back that in a demonic state would be bathed in alcohol just to create more pain, for example. She'd be taken on long walks and find herself, you know, without shoes and miles from where she lived, because what the demon had figured out was the weaker the body was, the easier it was for it to come and possess the body. And it actually said, I mean, in dialogues with the doctor, I want her dead, you know? I want her dead and in hell with me. I will be the real Clara Fowler when this is over. I am taking over this body. So that's basically, you know, how it started. But then it's almost turns into a murder mystery, because there are is a detective involved, a city marshal named Bassett, and his name is Rufus Bassett. That's a nickname, Hilliard. They called him Bassett because he was like a Basset hound. He had investigated the Lizzie Borden murders in Fall River. He was the Fall River city marshal.
Oh, wow.
He had investigated the Juan Corriaro murders, which happened within a 4-mile radius of the Lizzie Borden murders, 4 miles away, and within, I think, well, within 6 months, another fellow who didn't remember doing it axe murdered Bertha Manchester, his boss's wife, left her in a horrendous state, and so he had investigated those two murders, but he was convinced that Clara's father, who was an alcoholic and a wife beater and just a terrible guy, had killed her siblings. There were two, her brother and sister had been, let's say, died under mysterious circumstances. And Bassett was convinced that the father had done that. And so he wanted Clara to testify against her father. He wanted to find out what she knew, because she was in the house at the time, and testify against her father. It was an obsession with him. And, that set this sort of mystery in motion. He goes then to Boston. He sees that she's under the care of Prince and this team of, you know, renowned physicians, and says, you know, what the hell is going on? And that really sets up the story, I think.
And what exactly inspired you to write altogether? What got you started in writing?
Well, you know, this is a great story about teachers, you know, and my own view is, I have a granddaughter that's six, And I think these kind of ages, you know, this stage from, I don't know, early childhood, maybe 4 to 12 or something like that, are really significant life-forming experiences. And so I had a great teacher in the sixth grade. Her name was Miss Dorsey. You know, I could picture it like it was yesterday. Typical of schools in those days, I guess they still do it. They say, you know, what did you do over your summer vacation? You know, write an essay about it. Or who's your favorite hero? You know, it's an astronaut or whoever, an athlete, whatever. So I wrote an essay on Willie Mays, the baseball player. And so she came up to me at my desk and said, you know, sort of privately, this isn't the best essay, but it's the most unique essay. You have a unique way of looking at things that other people don't. And I encourage you to write. And frankly, you know, my background, my childhood was not the greatest. And so this was the first time somebody had really said something so complimentary, you know. And I took it to heart, and I started writing short stories. And my brother, who was going to St. Benedict's Prep in Newark, and I was in the sixth grade, seventh grade, started writing these stories. He would bring them to the monk, a fellow named Father Jeremiah. And Jeremiah liked the story so much, he started publishing them in the high school magazine.
Oh, wow.
So then, a few years later, I went to St. Benedict's and followed in my brother's footsteps and wound up being editor of that magazine. And I won the best short story award for the United Press International. I think there were, you know, maybe 6,000 entries or so. Mm-hmm. And so I won best short story, and it was made into a play. So I wrote the play, the script for the play as well as the story then. And that's really, you know, what really got me launched into saying, you know, this is something apparently I have some skill at, and I enjoy it. You know, that's how it started.
Like, I've been writing mostly my entire life, and I'm very artistically inclined. It started primarily with just actual artistic medium being sketching, painting, sculpting, and I always dabbled in writing, and primarily for assignments. I would go completely above and beyond for school writing assignments.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided that the stories my grandmother and my great aunt and a few other people who have long since passed on shared with me, I decided that in 2007 I was going to write a book, a collection of those stories they shared with me.
Wow, what a great idea. Uh-huh.
And it actually took off. Just as a hobby, I decided I'm going to do that in honor of them. And
yes,
it took off from there, and here we are in 2024. I have a new book coming out in October, and I've also illustrated children's books along with all of this, and doing an audiobook.
You're a Renaissance man.
Maybe, yeah.
Well, that's amazing. You know, I'm not much of a drawer or anything else, but I can write, and that's what I've really focused on over the years. And I love it. And you know, I used to be a deputy sheriff.
Oh yeah, so I remember that.
I used to write. I meet these horrible criminals. You know, federal prisoners is what I used to transport. And a lot of them were hitmen and terrorists and pedophiles and God knows what else. Not very nice people, which again inspired me somewhat to the theme of the unwelcome. But I started writing for True Detective then. I said, you know, as long as I'm here, I might as well interview these people, find out what happened from the cop's point of view, from their point of view. And so I started writing for True Detective. Then I wound up writing the Nick Carter series. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Nick Carter series, but GIs, you know, was very popular among, you know, soldiers, people overseas and whatnot. It was sort of the American James Bond. So okay. I wrote three or four of those with Martin Cruz Smith, who wrote Gorky Park. Maybe you remember that.
I do remember Gorky Park.
And Ken Follett, who of course went on to be a super selling author.
Mm-hmm.
So we all started writing the Nick Carter series under the name Nick Carter. So we were ghostwriting, you know.
That's a good way to start.
Well, occasionally I throw my name in as a character, so I just sort of sneak
Just
it
to
in.
keep it going.
So when it came out, I could say, see, I really did write it.
Now, dealing with some of the worst scum and villainy,
yeah,
have you ever yourself had any unexplainable experiences or paranormal encounters of your own?
You know, it's funny you should say that, because if you had asked me that question about 4 months ago, I would say no. But now I have to answer yes, and I'll tell you why, and it's interesting. It'll probably be my next book. But years ago, and when people ask me that, when I was doing the Mojave incident, did you ever have a UFO or abduction? Just out of hand, I would say no. But that really wasn't exactly the case, because I had a really vivid dream one time. I lived down at the Jersey Shore, very near the ocean, block from the ocean. But there was this huge pond that was in the other direction, you know, with an American flag, etc. And so I would walk my dog very early in the morning before work. And I had this dream. It was in the winter near the shore, so it was kind of dark and grim. And in the dream, I went to the pond where I'd go most every morning. And there was this object, this glowing object in the pond that I could see maybe 30 feet down. And of course, it was cold and wintry, so the last thing anyone would think about is, oh, let's jump in the water. But that's what I was compelled to do. Now, I didn't. This is a dream. But in the dream, I jumped in the water, and I found myself aboard this UFO. And I looked at my watch, and my watch had stopped, and I noticed that in particular. And I had a tour. I remember being shown maps and things of great interest in technology, and just almost like a cordial walkthrough. It just stuck with me. Then in the dream, I'm back holding the dog leash with the dog at the edge of the pond. I was amazed to feel my clothes were dry and my watch had started again. But that dream stuck with me for, well, even today. You know, I remember it vividly. But I felt really this euphoria for the next 3 weeks, 4 weeks. But, you know, then it went away, and it was something, well, I had a very vivid dream. Yeah. But then the Mojave incident happened, which was just the way I got that story was loaded with coincidences. A fellow that I worked for had played football with Steve Hess, who was one of the protagonists, and Dawn, his wife. He knew them very well. It was his best friend. They didn't want to talk about it. They had, terrible memories and nightmares from the experience. They didn't want to get into it. But because this fellow, Paul Moran, was a friend of mine and a friend of theirs, I know you're a writer, he said, I think this is a great story. And I know from that end, it would be good for you. And from there on, I think it would be good to tell the story just psychologically, because they're very depressed. They can't seem to get their feet back on the ground. Reluctantly, I did it. But again, a lot of coincidence. Then I'd had a knee surgery. I had a motorcycle accident, so I had a knee surgery on my left knee, and didn't think much of that either. Time went on, but then I had to get another surgery for meniscus. And after the surgery, the doctor came to me with an X-ray, and on the X-ray was something maybe the size of the nail on your pinky, and it was an arrow-shaped, and it was this silver sort of arrow-shaped object on my X-ray. And he said, you know, this is your X-ray of your knee. He goes, you have a piece of metal or something in there. I tried to get it when I opened up the knee. I tried to fish it out, but I couldn't get it, and I didn't want to create any damage. So I left it in and sewed it back up. But you should know that you have this in your knee. So I said, well, how would that happen? I mean, what's up with that? And he said, well, maybe they left a clip or something in, but it doesn't look like a clip. Maybe the tip of a surgical tool broke off and they couldn't retrieve it. He goes, those are the only things I can think, which are pretty unlikely, both of them. Then doesn't think anything of it, because he said it was not dangerous, no infection, because it had been there for years. He said, we just leave it alone. So about 4 months ago, I'm watching, I don't know, maybe Unsolved Mysteries or one of the shows like that. And this fellow gets on who claimed to be abducted by aliens, and said, all right, fine, gives his story. And what does he do but pull out an X-ray? And the X-ray has exactly what I had in my knee. And he says, I have an implant from this abduction, and it's in my knee, and this is the x-ray to prove it. And so they did some tests for radio waves and magnetism and whatnot. But then I said, you know, over these 30 years or whatever, it's you know, why was I the guy that wound up writing the Mojave incident? I was not a UFO guy or anything like that. It just fell in my lap. You know, why was I the guy that had this vivid dream that stayed with him so long? Why am I the guy that has this thing in his knee that no one can explain? And so one of the doctors that gave a great review to The Unwelcome, actually he said, The Unwelcome is, he said, it's an extraordinary journey into the uncharted regions of the human mind. And he is a medical doctor and a psychiatrist, and he does retrogressive hypnosis. So in May,
that's fun.
I'm going to go to Tampa, Florida, and he's going to retrogress me back to the day of the dream.
And see what comes up.
We're going to videotape it. And if it turns out to be something unusual, I'll have a surgeon take, no matter, you know, I mean, there's got to be a way to get this out of my knee and remove it and see what it is exactly.
If it does turn out to be like that, I would love to do a follow-up episode about that.
Well, it's a new book for sure. I mean, from the doctor's point of view, who had never done anything like this, and from mine as well, because it's really more of a, it's not like, you know, I was abducted by an alien. It's like a life story, kind of, you know?
Yeah. When I was very young, I had a strange bump that appeared on my calf muscle, and I was squeezing on it, pushing on it, moving it around, and I was squeezing hard enough that it actually popped up to the surface out of one of my pores, and it was the size and the look of a small BB. I don't recall ever having been shot with a BB gun, but it looked like that. It was a strange metallic object, and it was magnetic.
Really?
Yes. Huh. It was magnetic, which is unusual for a BB, because those are normally steel.
Yes.
But it did have magnetic properties. Now, that was probably when I was 11 or 12, and between then and now, I can't even tell you what happened to it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this one, fortunately, I'm not 12, and I will hold on to whatever comes out.
Yes, I would wear it around your neck. Maybe it'll have GPS coordinates.
That's right. But like I said, I think it's an interesting story. And again, it's just one of these things that, you know, again, sort of happenstance. I've been very fortunate with stories coming my way. You know, actually, I'd written a book about a congressman that had a run-in with J. Edgar Hoover. It was called The Privacy War. So who reads it but Salvatore Bill Bonanno, the head of the Bonanno crime family?
Oh.
He calls me and says, I love your book. And the reason he loved it, because it was basically not very flattering to the FBI, right?
Right.
So he loved it. And he goes, you know, this is the way they really operate, you know, because Hoover, of course, was not a very nice person. And so he wanted to maybe make a movie out of it. So we got to be friends. And son of a gun, if he doesn't say, you know, my father's physician is in New Jersey, and he's a surgeon. He lives in Arizona part-time and in New Jersey part-time. And he was also Carlo Gambino's physician and John Gotti's physician. How would you like to, you know, write a book about him? I said, well, it sounds pretty good to me. So I met the guy, and it turns out that at the time at the hospital there, I'm trying to think of the name of it. Anyways, it was in Edgewater. They had billboards, and they called them the Dream Team of Heart Surgeons. So there were four heart surgeons, and all over New Jersey, there were these billboards, the Dream Team of Surgeons, you know? And so this was one of them. And so I wrote the book, and got a lot of publicity, and they were so paranoid about this book that when the New York Post did a big expose, right? They bought up all the newspapers. They went to the newspaper stands everywhere, and they bought up all the New York Post in the area so that their patients wouldn't see it. I don't think that worked very well, though. But again, that's a story that just fell in my lap, you know?
Reminds me of the making of The Godfather, what they had to go through with the mob in order to get that taken care of.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's right.
Well, it was a real pleasure to speak with you, and this is something I'd love to follow up after your surgery, if you keep me in the loop with that, if they do remove it after your hypnosis.
I will. And I should mention, I do want to mention that The Unwelcome will be available on Friday, a week from today. It will be on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and everywhere you can order books. So it's The Unwelcome, The Curious Case of Clara Fowler.
And I have been plugging your book on all of my social media formats and providing as much word of mouth as I can, guerrilla marketing, cross-marketing. And it will also, I'm going to be using your book trailer from the link you sent me and putting that on my podcast. Because that's a really cool trailer.
Actually, I have another trailer, so maybe I'll forward that along to you, too, if you don't mind.
Please do. I want to keep your momentum going. Maybe every little bit will help more.
That's the way it goes. It's cumulative, I think, right? It's generally not about one thing. It's about a momentum, as you say.
Absolutely. It was a real pleasure speaking with you. I'm
glad. Same, Neil. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for giving me your time today.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you for giving me your time.
Absolutely.
All right.
Until we meet
care.
Again. Thanks.
Thanks again. Bye-bye. Book I want to tell you about, Shocking Case History, documented by Sigmund Freud's greatest rival, was 50 years in the making. The story behind it was suppressed for twice that long because the medical establishment didn't want you to know about it. Pre-order a copy on Amazon or wherever books are sold.
King Solomon purportedly wrote one of the earliest works in Western culture, where types of demons are classified by domain. The Testament of Solomon, in this piece, King Solomon describes his interactions with Beelzebub and other demons who he enslaves to help build his temple. The book also contains numerous rituals and sigils that are still used today to conjure demons. Demons listed by Seleucus in the 11th century, Michael Seleucus attempted to classify types of demons by domain. The type of demons that Seleucus divided demons into were imperial, which fiery, aerial, subterranean, lucifugius, which is heliophobic, aqueous, and terrestrial. Demons listed by the seven deadly sins. Deadly sin number one, pride, the lantern of light, an anomalous English Lollard tract often attributed to Wycliffe, was also unknown at that time, a work that is now believed to be written by Wycliffe himself. The book categorized types of demons based upon the seven deadly sins. These types of demons that Wycliffe used would be later found in the books by John Taylor, the water poet. St. Catherine of Siena attacked by demons, deadly sin number one. Deadly sin one is demon Lucifer. Deadly sin number two is envy, Beelzebub. Number three, wrath, Satan. Number four of the deadly sins, sloth, which is Abaddon. Deadly sin number five, greed, which is Mammon. Number six, the deadly sin and the demon for gluttony is Belphegor. Number seven, the deadly sin of lust is Asmodeus. Spina's list of demons inspired by different legends and stories of his time, Alsfonios de Spina, in 1467, classified demons by incubi and succubi, demons that have sex with the living. Demons of fate, otherwise known as the angel of death. Wandering groups or armies of demons, otherwise known as legion. Familiars, which are animal spirit guides for witches and warlocks, who are considered personal demons. Druids, in German folklore, it is an evil spirit that causes nightmares. Cambions and other demons that are born from the union of a demon with a human being, which
is also Nephilim. Mischievous demons, which are imps and worker demons. I've encountered many of those upon investigations. Demons that attack clergy. The Exorcist is a prime example of that. Demons that entice people into the occult and witchcraft. Bensfield's types of demons. In The Prince of Hell by Peter Bensfield in 1589, different types of demons again are classified by the seven deadly sins. The only exception is that the names of the demons are slightly different than Lantern of Light. Number one, Lucifer is pride. Mammon is once again greed. Asmodeus is lust. Leviathan is envy. Beelzebub is gluttony. Satan is wrath. And Belphegor is sloth again. The King James Bible's version of demons. Several years prior to the King James Bible, in 1591, King James wrote, Demon a la guerre separates demons into four types based on what that devil causes torture on the living and the dead. Spectra, in the modern world, referred to a haunting, spectra, or spirits of the dead that haunt places or objects. Obsession, ghosts or spirits that haunt people. Possession, demon or spirits that take over the actual body and soul of the living. And that only happens to the willing. Fairies, spirits or demons that give advice to the living. They commonly live within heavily wooded areas and places of enchantment like Ireland and Scotland. Types of demons according to Michaelis, types of demons that Sebastian Michaelis has in his own book, The Admirable History, were given to him by the demon Berith. When he was exorcising a nun, his classification system is based upon the sin the devil tempts the living to commit. First hierarchy, princes of fallen angels. Beelzebub, the demon that tempts men with pride, is opposed by St. Francis of Assisi. Leviathan, the demon that tempts people to give into heresy and is opposed by St. Peter. Asmodeus, the demon that tempts men into wantonness, is opposed by St. John the Baptist. Berith, the demon who tempts men to commit murder, is opposed by St. Barnabas. Astaroth, the demon tempts men to be lazy, opposed by St. Bartholomew. Verine, the demon tempts men with impatience, and he is opposed by St. Dominique. Grizzil, the demon tempts men with impurity, opposed by St. Bernard. Son Elan, the demon tempts men to hate, and he is opposed by St. Stephen. The second hierarchy, of course, demons of powers, dominions, and virtues. Cariou, the demon of powers, and is opposed by St. Vincent and Vincent Ferrer. Carnival, this demon tempts men to obscenity and shamelessness, and he is opposed by John the Evangelist. Oilette, the demon that tempts men to vow of poverty, is opposed by St. Martin. Rosier, a demon of dominions. This demon, he tempts men against sexual purity. He is opposed by St. Basil. Belias, a demon of virtues. This demon, he tempts men with arrogance and women to be vain. Raise their children as wantons, and St. Francis de Paul opposes gossip during Mass. And there's a third hierarchy, and it's pretty much the same as the first and second hierarchy. Not a lot changes between those three variations. Now, the nine types of demons, according to Francis Barrett, and Francis Barrett's books, The Magus, written in 1801, offered this, his classification for types of demons. Beelzebub, the keeper of false gods, demons of false idols and prophets. Pythias, spirit of lying, the demon of liars. This must be the demon that possesses Donald Trump. Belial, vessel of iniquity, demons of evil things. Asmodeus is the demon of wickedness. Satan is the imitator of miracles, the demon of witchcraft. He's the author of confusion, of course. Miriam, he has aerial powers, and also is the demon of pestilence. Abaddon Fiores is the demon of discord. Astaroth Calminators is the demon of inquisitors and fraudulent accusers. And Mammon Malagini is the demon of tempters and ensnarers. And that is a list that I felt needed to be shared. It's kind of like a walk down the book of Genesis lesson for you today. This is exactly why they call me Preacher when I'm at the Mothman Festival and various other conventions and festivals, doing lectures and speaking, because I tie in a lot of spirituality and historical knowledge, both world history and biblical history, into my teachings and what I write about and talk about. Thanks for hanging out with me this long. And now, a word from our sponsor.
Boston, 1898. Clara Fowler arrives at the office of renowned psychotherapist Dr. Morton Prince, plagued by visions, exalted by apparitions of the Virgin Mary, cursed by a demonic presence obsessed with her demise. A city marshal pursues Clara, hell-bent on pinning the murders of her infant siblings on her father and uncovering their connection to the serial killings of Jack the Ripper and H.H. Holmes. What happens next is more shocking than the grizzled lawman could ever imagine. The Unwelcomed by Ron Felber. Pre-order on Amazon or where books are sold.
Well, thank you, and that's it for today. I had a lot of fun talking with my new friend and fellow author and researcher, Ron Felber. I'm hoping to get him back on the show in the near future. He will be undergoing hypnosis to determine what exactly was with the lucid dream that he had that felt so real, and then happening upon an implant in his knee. See if those two things are connected. If so, I will have him back on this season. If not, I'll have him back on eventually, because he was extremely interesting to speak with and a very pleasant person. Someone that I feel I could learn a lot from. Thank you so much for giving me your undivided attention, and I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Have a great week, and I will see you next time on more of Paranormally Speaking. I'm your host, Neil Parks, and until then, Godspeed.
T-Mobile believes customers deserve to get more without paying more. Everything from entertainment benefits like Netflix on Us to travel benefits to Scam Shield protection, all with taxes and fees included. So the price you see is the price you pay. When you're a T-Mobile customer, you get over $225 in value every month in benefits with our Max Family plan.
That's like paying for nosebleed seats and getting to sit in the front row.
That's right. At T-Mobile, your family gets over $225 worth of value and benefits with our max plan each and every month. Plus, with our price lock guarantee, we won't raise your rate plan price for talk, text, and data ever.
That's like paying for a cab and getting a stretch limo.
At T-Mobile, you get value beyond the expected.
Qualifying service required. Value based on included monthly benefits. Sales tax and regulatory fees included in Max's monthly price. Price lock guarantees rate price of talk, text, and data for new accounts with qualifying service. Exclusions apply. See details at T-Mobile.com.